And I'm Doyle.
I pledge allegiance to the flag, to the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, good job, Pooh.
Thanks.
Right here. All right, let's go grab you a stool there. Pull one up. Here's one right here. All right, well, everybody, welcome to the Hour of the Time. Tonight, Pooh is going to be my co-host. I am Doyle. This is Pooh. And we're going to do the show together. Bill's working on some very important stuff right now. So I'm going to do the show with Pooh tonight. I think that what we'll start out with is that article that we were reading last night. So we can go ahead and read some more to you about the concentration camps from... what would you call it? The liberal or so-called left-wing or liberal viewpoint. This is an original article. It's from a very left magazine, Look. So-called left. Look magazine. It's from May 28, 1968. So if you want to check it out, you can do that. It's from May 28, 1968. And the cover story is America's Concentration Camps. Okay. We covered the first part of this article last night, and we'd like to go ahead and continue tonight with the next part of the article. It's a very large article, a lot of pages to it. So we're going to read to you from here, and so you can hear exactly what they were writing back in 1968, I don't know what you call them, the left wing or whatever you want to call it, the people that accuse everybody else of having conspiracy theories about concentration camps or government roundups or whatever. Well, here you go. This is in their own writing. Okay. Let's start this off. Okay, so first off, well, let's recap the last paragraph so we can catch everybody up here. Title 2, Section 104, small c of the McCarran Act provides that persons detained shall be confined in such places of detention as may be prescribed by the Attorney General. In 1952, accordingly, the Justice Department designated six sites for the detention camp program, in quotes. Those were, the camps were set up on a standby basis at Allenwood, Pennsylvania, Avon Park, Florida, El Reno, Oklahoma, Florence and Wickenburg, Arizona, and Tule Lake, California. So, the United States does indeed have a concentration camp law, as well as camp facilities to match. Yet both were byproducts of Joe McCarthy era frenzy, and neither law nor camps have ever been put to use for emergency detention purposes. Well, they still maintain these. We have pictures. Okay, very strange. Remember, this is written back in 1968. Okay, continue. The most authoritative document quoted by anti-concentration campers is a fiery 60-page booklet called Concentration Camps USA by freelance reporter Charles R. Allen Jr. This booklet, published in 1966 by the left-oriented Citizens Committee for Constitutional Liberties, in parentheses CCCL, suggests there are dark forces afoot in government now making ready for mass imprisonments. Without citing sources, Allen claims to have learned, for example, of 1 million formal detention warrants, all freshly printed by the Internal Security Division of the Judicial Department and ready to be served on potential subversives come the proper time. As a starter, he says, under the clause that calls for Title II to be invoked in the event of insurrection in aid of a foreign enemy, Negro rioters will be marked for mass detention in cases where, as in Detroit, the rioting is designated an insurrection. That the insurrection must be in aid of a foreign enemy is no real problem, Allen believes, since nearly every major riot has been said to be inspired or directed or at least favorably looked upon by communists, i.e. foreign enemies. I'd have to agree with him there. There is a lot of intervention from outside sources in riots within this country. I think we can look at the LA riots and see that. To continue, I'm very suspect of these people making these allegations, says Assistant Attorney General J. Walter Yeagley, whose Internal Security Division administers the McCarran Act. I resent it. Not only did we drop plans along those lines, but Congress hasn't appropriated any money for detention camp purposes. It was decided around 1957 that there was no further need to maintain the camps. End quote. Allen claims that under something called Operation Dragnet, the FBI can, on a moment's notice, stage a huge roundup of all persons named on a master pickup list of probable subversives and whatnot. Mr. Hoover wouldn't stand for it, insists Yeagley. He's not going to let his agents go around picking up people. As far as persons of foreign influence are concerned, it's always been his job to know who they are. It's his and the White House's job to know what can and what should be done with them. We have a pretty open society, Yeagley says. We have so darn many communication lines and airports and railroad yards and facilities that it's not possible to protect them all from sabotage. People felt some provisions should be made to detain persons who may be prone to sabotage. Should the law be repealed? It's not for me to comment on. I don't want to say the time might not come when we wish we had something. I see pros and cons on both sides. In Yeagley's and other government offices, the frantic inquiries keep piling up. The form letter reply of 186 concludes, "You may be assured that the rumors you have heard are unfounded, and that the government has no plans to reactivate detention centers anywhere in the country." It is signed Merle E. Alexander, Director, U.S. Bureau of Prisons. Under the law, the Bureau is responsible for maintenance of detention camps. Camps where, charges Miriam Friedlander of the CCL, certain things are being done. "I think," says Alexander, "if I lived in the south side of Chicago and Harlem, all this would be a highly credible rumor to me. Actually, in terms of potential detainees from city riots, that's no violation of federal law. This will be local and state responsibility, not the federal government's." What about the vague rumblings concerning the detention program in the alleged camp building? "We have no facilities for this program," Alexander insists. "Only three of the original sites are still maintained by the Bureau and are now used for other purposes." Should the law be repealed? "That's a high-level policy matter," he smiles. "I just run the Bureau of Prisons." Here's the shape of things now at the six original centers. The Allenwood, Pennsylvania camp, covering 4,200 acres, is operated by the Bureau as a minimum security facility for 230 inmates, mostly selective service violators. There are no guns, towers, high fences, or armed guards. This is necessary living areas, a furniture factory, and grazing space for 750 white-faced heifers. If there are plans to update the camp for McCarran Act purposes, camp administrator P.A. Schurer claims he has heard nothing about them. There's really nothing going on here, as you can see. In 1961, the camp at Avon Park, Florida, was leased by the Army Corps of Engineers of the state of Florida, which has since incorporated the facility into its own prison system. The Florence, Arizona camp, used for prisoners of war in the 1940s, now serves as a minimum security federal jail for those waiting trial. It currently is holding about 80 individuals, says Alexander, and is in physically deteriorating condition. Though the building still stands at the campsite in Wickenburg, Arizona, the property itself has been returned to a private leaser. At El Reno, Oklahoma, the Bureau of Prisoners has dismantled its detention barracks and now maintains the property, says Alexander, for beef herd pastures. the large relocation center at Tule Lake, California, which held 22,500 Japanese Americans during World War II, has been divided up among numerous new owners, including the township of Newell. The 79-acre heart of the camp, with 45 buildings that once served as staff housing, was sold to Harold A. Fletcher in 1959. Fletcher bought the land for development and resale as residential lots. Contrary to rumor, the government has no special reentry rights and could reclaim the area only by right of eminent domain. Besides the 77-year-old Fletcher, there was talk at one of the recent local Chamber of Commerce meetings of a whole new camp to be built in nearby Devil's Garden. As for Tule Lake, I don't think they'll come in now. The property is too split up. But, he adds, I don't know what the government will do. Nobody does. A probing into every available official record and a running down of every current rumor yield no evidence either of physical preparation or of plans by the federal government for mass-level incarceration of Americans via Title II of the McCarran Act. Still, the law lies on the books. The campsites exist, and the stories and the anguish continue to proliferate. Military planners in Washington do acknowledge that detention of these centers on at least a limited basis could conceivably take place should prolonged, simultaneous, and seemingly coordinated urban riots reach such grand-scale, nationally disruptive proportions as to require the declaration of martial law. Historically, it's the right of government and self-defense to protect itself, explained the U.S. Army lawyer. Use of martial law would mean full military control of the designated areas, suspension of bail and mass arrests on the basis of suspicion alone. We're awake to this possibility, says a general in the Pentagon, but we consider it rather remote. These rumors become rampant in times of tension like this, says U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who declares there have been and will be no concentration camps in this country. I don't feel Title II poses any threat for us. It's also academic because it's so remote. I don't believe it has even been brought to my attention except in the context of emergency measures in the event of foreign attack. Should the law be repealed? In the terms of priorities, replied the Attorney General, I'd rather have open housing legislation. Over and over again, I was reminded by officials that the entire Internal Security Act of 1950 was an outgrowth of a different era of national nervousness and hysteria. Obviously, therefore, the thing can't be taken too seriously today, or can it? Though the old McCarthyism, as it's called, as such, is clearly out of date, there hangs across the country a new atmosphere of malaise, tinted in anxiety, negativism, and all-around bad vibrations. A few miscellaneous symptoms. After a steady 5-year decline, federal prison population has swollen this year beyond normal capacity. This increase is due primarily to selective service violators, the nearest U.S. equivalent, says some say, to political prisoners. Second, with official credibility, now at its nadir, the government appears not as a source of help, but as a grand-scale conniver and suppressor. Third, with hymns of hate heard tuning up across the land, many city jails have already had a foretaste of overcapacity crowds from April's uprisings. Racial tension may be building toward new explosions. And finally, as a discomforting parallel, the U.S. Senate is now seriously considering the Internal Security Act of 1968. Among other remarkable innovations, this bill, offered by Mississippi Senator James Eastland with 19 senator co-sponsors, would henceforth apply the rigid wartime definition for treasonable conduct to peacetime activities as well. If the Eastern bill passes, warns American Civil Liberties Union legal director Melvin Wolf, that, by definition, would constitute national hysteria. Under malign conditions like these, even the most extreme concentration camp atrocity tales sound instantly believable and imminently threatening. It is partly as a reflection of this new uneasiness that the National Board of ACLU has only now felt moved to petition the government for a judgment declaring Title II of this 18-year-old act unconstitutional and hence unenforceable. If people felt it was real, says Wolf, Well, they are. The mere existence of the camps is really beside the point. If the law went into effect, they'd have no trouble finding some place to put them all. Ain't that the truth? Since the law has never been used, it has never been tested in court, where, most fail, it would be adjudged unconstitutional. But, meantime, it exists, says one Washington lawyer, as a constantly overhanging danger. Meantime, it exists in the minds of many Negroes as the penultimate symbol of social entanglement and alienation. Meantime, it exists for young white activists as a psychological sword poised over the heads of would-be dissenters. It is not enough to say that this probably would not be done, wrote President Truman in his veto message. The mere fact that it could be done shows clearly how the bill would open a Pandora's box of opportunities for official condemnation of organizations and individuals for perfectly honest opinions. The basic error of this section is that they move in the direction of suppressing opinion and belief, a long step towards totalitarianism. The law, the camps, and the whole concept may not seem especially desirable or workable to most of those in government today, but neither should be dismissed as past aberrations in our political system. Their creation and their existence mirror the feelings of Americans at that time, and it's not impossible to foresee such feelings coming up again. In short, it could happen here. And it did. Well, naturally, we'll have to comply with the law, says one federal official. Even without camps, we could transfer and double up in our prisons to hold people. We've got the town and the staff to sit down and start working out transfers in a hurry. But we'd have to make our decisions based on the number of people involved. The whole key is the number. He paused. Then, half laughingly, in a smaller voice, thought aloud, we'd have a problem. Oh, that's a major article there, Pooh. What do you think?
It sounds pretty good.
Oh, did it? Did I read it good, or does the story sound good?
You read it good.
Ah, all right. Well, I think what we'll do now is, why don't we cover our format tonight? I wanted to finish up that article first. And then what we're going to do is we're going to cover some open topics. Then we're going to cover the commercial time, in which time we'll have to shut off 101.1 FM, Eager. Then when we turn 101.1 back on, FM, we'll open the lines up and we'll have open questions. All right. Cool. How about you, Pooh? What do you think?
Sounds
okay. Yeah?
Okay with me.
Alrighty. What do you want to cover first tonight? Okay, I remember. That's okay. Anyway, I've had a lot of questions directed at me about the antennas, the antenna kits, how to arrange them, how to better receive a shortwave signal. So I'd like to cover that for a few minutes real quick. In fact, I've had two calls just today alone about that, just prior to the show, about how they can better receive a shortwave signal. Okay. The key to shortwave receiving, at least, is the antenna. Okay. You need to have a proper antenna arrangement if you can do so. I know that some of the people, depending on where they live, maybe in tall high-rises or in condominium complexes or very heavy-walled structures, you know, heavy concrete, a lot of steel, it really poses a problem in blocking the signal. But there's various solutions to this. If you have the space and can do it, set up a long wire or dipole antenna. This is quite easy to do. It consists of really just a few insulators to keep the antenna from touching anything else and to suspend it. The antenna wire itself, which is bare copper, and the lead-in wire. Shielded, insulated, you know, whatever type that you feel you can use or need to use. There's two arrangements that are typically used. It's a long wire arrangement, which is just a wire suspended in essentially a straight line, and to pick up signal. The best way to do this, if you're going to use a long wire type arrangement, is do this perpendicular, so you'll form a T to the signal transmission to the station which you most desire to hear or the area which you most desire to receive from. It's much easier for the antenna, suspended in a long wire fashion, to be perpendicular to the signal as close as possible. So if you were in Southwest and you wanted to pick up something in the New England states or whatnot, or WDCQ in Maine, you would string the antenna in sort of a southeast fashion, southeast to northwest fashion, and that way it would be perpendicular roughly to the signal, and you'll get a much better reception because of how the radio waves come out and how they bounce off the ionosphere and how the skip works. You'll get a much better signal. If you run a wire that is, for all intents and purposes, straight on with the signal, you've got very little surface area to pick it up, so you get much worse reception. Try to make it perpendicular. If you want a really good arrangement, set up a dipole antenna. Again, set it perpendicular to the signal. Excuse me. When you do this, I explained this on a prior show, how to arrange the whole thing, and we have instructions and whatnot. It's essentially just a V dipole hinge. You have two antennas, essentially, and arrange it in a half wavelength fashion. It picks up the signal very well. It cuts down the length of wire you need, and you just arrange it in a perpendicular manner to the area or the region or the part of the country or the transmitter station that you want to receive from most of the time. Now, the stations are, it's pretty easy to do this. That may sound real difficult. You don't need compass bearings and azimuths and all this to do that. Just guesstimate it. That's the word I'm going to use, guesstimate it. Okay? You don't need to even get out a map. Just know that I live here, and if I want to listen to WDCQ really good, I want it to face WDCQ, so it takes on the reception head on in a perpendicular manner, right across the middle of it. And I know Maine's up here, so just aim it that way. That's really what it comes down to. Okay, and the dipole is just a V. It can be inverted or a straight V and aimed at the area. A 60-degree angle is the so-called ideal angle for the wires to be apart in the V. I can't prove this, but I've read that the reason for that is because the 60 degrees is an even split, okay, from the ground plane. The ground plane would be 180 degrees flat. You know, ground below you, whatever. So 60 degrees is an even slice right out of the middle. And since it's an upright fashion, it's the best way to pick up reception. Okay? When you hook up your lead-in wire, whether it be a shielded or just an insulated wire to go into your radio, okay, you need to make sure that you secure this very well. After you secure the wire to the antenna, the bare copper to the insulated wire or the shielded wire, wrap it up. Wrap it up really good with electrical tape. Keeps out the weather, keeps out the condensation. It's going to cause interruptions in your signal. It's going to cause noise. Plus, moisture will seek to, it'll try to go up that insulation, especially if you're using coaxial cable. If you're using a shielded cable, if you get water up that cable, you're going to have a big problem with corrosion. It just throws the transmission, the sound, everything, throws it all out the window. So that's why you want to wrap it securely. There is a product which you can use. I used it back home, and it just popped in my head this morning after thinking about it. I used it back home for a lot of things. It's called liquid electrical tape. It's known by other names. It's made by Scotch-Brite makes it. 3M makes it. It's a black gooey stuff in a can. You just brush on like a rubber cement. And it acts just like electrical tape, but because you brush it on and it dries, it makes a real nice shape-conforming feel. It'll get in all the nooks and crannies and seal everything out really well. But electrical tape works just fine also. That's what we use here. And any problems, we have a long wire arrangement here. Works very well. It gave us better reception once we set it up than we had ever had before, and it was quite simple to do. Once you seal out that connection, make sure that when you run your lead-in wire to your antenna, or excuse me, to your receiver, be it a portable radio or more of a base station, like the Kenwoods and whatnot, or the old tube-fed ones, which are the best in my mind, as far as I'm concerned. They run very hot, but they have excellent reception, very good sound. When you run it in there, they typically have two receptacles. They have an antenna and a ground. Make sure to properly ground your equipment, okay? When you ground your equipment, there's two ways to do it. If it's on a very modern transistor-type portable radio, it's not going to have a separate ground, more than likely. So what you need to do is run the static block in line. You can buy these at Radio Shack. They're very simple to install. They go right in line. You just snip the wire, plug it in both sides. They might use F connectors. That's like your VCR TV type connectors if you're using shielded wire. If not, they have screw terminals for insulated wire. And what this does is, if the static buildup in the line gets to an excessive point, it's a fusible link. It'll melt. It won't let it come in, and it won't be a big lightning magnet, okay? Because if you get a huge amount of static buildup on an antenna, and you have it shot up in the air, and you have your big dipole arrangement, and it's a very tall object, probably comparable to most houses in the area, if you arrange one, it's going to be a lightning magnet if you let a lot of static build up, okay? So that static block, what it does, it acts as a fusible link. The static gets too high, it melts, breaks the connection to your equipment. It's a real simple procedure, and boom, if you have a problem, either high static build up, which will destroy modern, portable, especially portable, I say that because it's small size, pretty much requires that they're all transistor, integrated circuit. A high level of static electricity will wipe out the circuits in no time, and your radio is going to be no good anymore. And you can kind of hear this coming, a prelude to this. If you are listening to shortwave and you have a storm coming or a lot of clouds and whatnot, you can hear little pops. If you have an antenna, an external antenna, you can hear little pops in the speaker. That's actually the electrical discharge that's going on in the air from cloud to cloud and whatnot. You may not see lightning yet, but that's the electrons flowing around cloud to cloud, and they're getting picked up and they make your speakers pop. Just a little popping sound if you got a loose connection. It's a good time to unplug your equipment. Okay? Now, if you have a base type unit, a modern Kenwoods and whatnot, or the $10,000 units, or whatever you might have, or the older tube-fed units, they will typically have a separate ground lug. And it's typically a spade connection. It's that U-looking terminator on a wire that you put on there. You want to run a good ground. It adds some extra protection to your equipment. And the better you protect it, the longer it's going to last. Because those static charges and whatnot hurt your equipment over time. As they build up and pop it, and the speaker popping like I described and whatnot, they do hurt your equipment. So if you can properly ground it and protect it on the incoming line, your equipment's going to last a lot longer, and you're going to be a lot safer personally. Because you don't want to be holding on to this stuff if you have a big electrical problem. If it's properly grounded, you also have better sound. Who wants to hear all those pops and stuff when they're trying to listen to a broadcast? You get rid of that with, like I say, the static block or a proper grounding system with a true grounding rod to a grounding lug on a home type unit, a base station type unit, much better sound. You get rid of a lot of the interference and electricity that builds up on the wire. Okay? If you have any more questions about this stuff, if I can try to answer them, I will. You can call in to our phone line, and that's 1 to 5 p.m. Mountain Time. 1 to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, Mountain Time. And the number is 520-333-4578. I hope that with the program a couple weeks ago and some of the highlights I've given tonight, that'll help you arrange, because if you can hear this show better, you're going to enjoy the radio listening more. You're going to enjoy the content of the show more. And there's a lot of good stuff out there to hear. We, Bill and I and Annie and Pooh and Allison and Crusher and everybody out here listen to the radio quite a bit. And there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. You can pick up foreign countries and whatnot. We listen to Radio Taipei International and Radio Canada International, and hear BBC, hear foreign news reports. You can hear the things that are going on in foreign countries as they're reporting it, hopefully before it's been sifted too much. And you can also hear a lot of foreign music. I picked up like a Taiwanese music quite often on Sundays. We even heard one evening, what was it, Havana's top 20 disco hits or something. I don't know what it was. So I guess it's their top 10 comparison to ours nowadays, but it's music that was popular here 20 or so years ago, and it was out of Havana. There's a lot of stuff to listen to out there, a lot of good shows. Okay, this is real simple stuff to do, and I think you'll really enjoy it once you get into it. Set up your antenna and your radio and whatnot properly, and you're going to have a heyday. Film too?
Nothing.
What are you doing? Praying?
No.
Oh. You got a sneeze?
No.
Oh. Anyway. What? I think we're going. Oh, who's that with you?
A little kitty cat.
Okay. What's your kitty cat's name?
Sarah.
Sarah? How old Sarah? Sarah is a doll, everybody, that Pooh brought in to accompany us as we do the show tonight. Okay, what was the next thing we talked about outside, Pooh? Anyway, okay, I'll go on. She knows what it is. I know she's going to remember. Some people called about first aid stuff yesterday, what to have and whatnot. I guess people were concerned about the areas they live in and whatnot, or being prepared for natural disasters or man-made whatnot. And so we have a small compilation here that I put together of basic medical supplies and things to think about in the medical area to have on hand. Now, I have a cousin, very very close cousin to me. We grew up together. She's a great gal, Berta. She's a lawyer, unfortunately. But she lived in L.A. and right out of Davis Law School and top graduate, all that stuff, and went to L.A. to make it big. And well, she ended up right on top of the L.A. riots after she lived there for a while, and got quite an eye opener as to what can happen. Things go bad as far as because of disasters and whatnot. See, right. We had to do our handshake there, anyone, Pooh. Disasters, as far as natural, like the earthquakes, she went through it all within a couple year span. Earthquakes, massive fires, and riots. Essentially, you're cut off. You're an island unto your own. And that can be a very disheartening feeling, okay? She's by herself. In an apartment complex, and buildings within eyesight, right from her window, living room window, are being burned down. And pretty soon electricity was cut. You know, as the power grid goes down, electricity goes down. And I don't think it was cut intentionally. It was just an after effect of power poles and whatnot burning down and transformers. And no one's going to go in and service them when people are throwing bricks at each other. But one thing that you have to consider is if you have special medical needs, as far as like diabetics or medication on high blood pressure, anything like this, you need to think about this. You need to have this stuff on hand, extras. And you need to have this information written down in a safe place in case you find yourself as a victim. And this could mean you may be there with your whole family, but if you fall victim to circumstances, and you can't describe what you're taking to the paramedic who shows up, it needs to be written down somewhere accurately. If you're hurt, or a family member is hurt, and they're on a prescription-type medication, like a diabetic person, or a high blood pressure, and especially the extreme cases, or a heart-type medication, or a kidney or liver-type medication, any of these, this prescription that you're on all the time, every day, to keep your body trying to function normally. This stuff needs to be down, and someone needs to know what to do, because a paramedic, when he shows up, He has to assess the situation based on, one, what he can pick up from his professional experience and training, and number two, what he's told. So if one of your family members or you yourself, and you can give it to a family member, have special needs, also allergic conditions, these need to be noted so that a professional that shows up on the scene can be given these things and better analyze the situation. Because it'd be a real pity, to be hurt or passed out and be allergic to penicillin, all because someone didn't say something, you get a penicillin injection, or something that counteracts your high blood pressure medicine, and to die from it. There's just no sense in it, okay, if you can avoid it. And it's very easy to avoid. Just a little prior preparation makes things a lot easier. That's one thing you need to think about. You need to have these prescription medications. If that is a factor in your family's life or your life, whatnot, if you're by yourself, you need to have these prescription medications, a backup source on hand, in a good, safe spot. Don't store them underneath your kitchen sink so they can get Clorox and everything else on them. Store them in a good, safe place, you know, in the prescription bottle or a Ziploc bag with instructions in case you were to be found. Because paramedics and people that show up on the scene, they're not stupid people. They're investigators. And they're people that know how to investigate and find this information out now. So they go to things like medicine cabinets and whatnot. They know these things. So have your medications and a backup supply and a good, like in a Ziploc bag with some basic instructions as far as maybe dosage rates or why you're on a certain medication. Many medications are used for different, I don't know what to call them, problems with your physiology. I hate to say that, but I don't know what else to call them. So you need to say what yours are used for. Now, obviously, this is much easier if you live, you know, with a large family and whatnot. There's always extra sources to espouse this information. But remember, they need to be kept out of direct sunlight, out of extreme heat and cold, and in a good watertight deal. Good standby deal is have some extra medication, put in a Ziploc bag, some basic instructions while you're on it, whatever, the conditions, the dosage, and then keep it right in the medicine cabinet, because that's right where a professional person is going to go to, okay? Whether it be a paramedic, a hardcore paramedic only line, emergency responder, an incident commander, whatever you want to call them, in that realm, or a firefighter, they're going to go right to certain spots to find out information. Okay, then I also had questions about some of the basic other medical supplies that could be had on hand to make things easier in the time of anything from minor scrapes and cuts to big bad problems. Okay, hopefully we won't get into those. We don't want to be doing any open surgery at home, but to cover the basics, it's really simple. Now I'm going to give you those items which you need on hand. And then I'm going to also tell you first, though, how to get them. Now, you can buy these items as a name brand, let's say Johnson & Johnson and whatnot. And you're probably going to pay more. The thing is, though, is that there are numerous companies out there that subcontract out their medical products. And they carry their name. And it has right on the packaging, on many of them, who their parent company is, or who manufactured it for them, and the lifespans. Now, these life expectancies, especially on medical items, are sort of slated because of litigation nowadays. So if it's got an expiration date on a Band-Aid 6 months from now, you can pretty much ignore it. And I say that in the sense that if you haven't broken the package, you haven't exposed it to germs or harsh conditions, haven't left it out in the rain for 3 weeks in the driveway or something, it's probably going to be just fine. It's probably going to stop the bleeding just fine. The gauze and the adhesive and all that is not going to just deteriorate overnight. But because of modern-day litigation, companies are fearful of being sued into non-existence, so they put these expiration dates on these items. Okay, now remember, this is, I'm not giving you advice here as far as break all these dates and don't worry about it. All I'm saying is this. If you need to use something and there's bleeding going on with somebody, a major cut, don't go around looking for another Band-Aid because the one you have in your hand has expired a month. Don't worry about it. And as far as sterility guaranteed, which you'll often see, that's why I say that that way, it's a quote, sterility guaranteed until this date. If you fall down the hillside and cut yourself badly, the sterility is out the window because your knee is probably full of dirt anyway. Okay? That's why you want to clean it and get a proper bandage on. From the basics that have on hand. Now remember, you can get these from these alternative sources. When I say that, I mean, like I said, the subcontractors. And you have all sorts of more medicals out there. A lot of people that repackage stuff or have it made just for them. Okay? All they do is throw it in a different box when it's manufactured and it says their brand name on it. You can get these on sale often. Quite inexpensive at your major chain stores, your Targets and whatnot. You can buy this stuff a lot cheaper than if you go right to a medical-specific store. If you go right to a medical outlet where they have the oxygen bottles and wheelchairs and whatnot, you're going to pay a premium for this stuff. So go to a source that can buy them in a larger, in a bulk, buy them by the train load, like a large chain store. And you can get just the basic stuff, keep it in a nice little bag, a nice little chest, have everything you need to cover everything from scrapes and hard spills off the bike from your children and yourself to really bad lacerations until you can get to professional medical care. Some of the stuff you want to have on hand is like your adhesive bandages, your normal Band-Aids, we'll call them, you know, your rectangular shaped self-adhesive bandages, okay? They have different types, you know, you'll hear about knuckle bandage, fingertip, butterfly, all this. If you can stick to just a couple of them, or if you have to because of budget or space or whatnot, stick to a standard adhesive bandage, normal Band-Aid, and then like a butterfly bandage. A butterfly bandage or a strip bandage. There seems to be a new line out now. I used to see them at work coming out the last couple years. Helps close bigger cuts because you actually pull the cut closed by hooking one side on one side of the laceration, pulling a little tauntingly and sticking the other side. It helps the wound close up quicker and thus prevent prolonged bleeding. Okay, next thing. Just some the rolls of surgical or adhesive tape for gauze bandages. Buy them all over the place. Almost any store carries them in their pharmacy and whatnot. It's really cheap stuff. You'll see them in widths like quarter, half inch, three quarter inch, usually one quarter inch increments. All you need is a roll of like a quarter inch and a roll of an inch, and you're going to cover almost every need because this stuff's quite easy. If you need a little thinner than an inch, just peel off the edge. It's real simple. Now you can use this stuff, your adhesive tape, your surgical type tape, to close a wound. You can use it to adhere, make the bandages adhere like a gauze bandage over something, whether it be a burn or an open cut or whatnot, or just even an insect or an insect bite or a reptile bite. You need to protect them because they are open wounds, and you want the bandage there to keep out infections and dust and germs, and you also want to draw out. It actually does act like a sponge. It does help. It'll kind of draw the wound to a head, I guess you'll say. Okay. One of the other basic items you're going to want to have on hand is your basic gauze sterile pads. They come in a whole plethora of sizes. You just want a bare bones, just a few things to have around in the medicine chest. Just get your normal everyday sizes, 2x3 inch, 3x3 inch, because you can cut them down, and they're plenty big enough for most circumstances. Now you need some antiseptic of some sort. Now there's various things to use here: iodine, peroxide, rubbing alcohol. It's isopropyl. It's not food grade alcohol. It's isopropyl alcohol. You have hydrogen peroxide and iodine. Those are the three most popular. And betadine for cleaning out wounds, keeping out the germ, fighting the germs. These can be bought all over the place. I have seen this stuff at gun shows. I've seen this stuff at your big chain stores and pharmacies, medical supply houses, all over. So. Oh, okay. My co-host is leaving. Okay, so you can. These are things that can be bought in a fairly large quantity, and when I say that, I mean a pretty good sized bottle. I'm talking like 25, 30 ounces cheap. Recently, a local store here, kind of a general merchandise store, a kind of a small local chain, Walmart type imitation, I don't know. It had very large bottles of alcohol, rubbing alcohol, and hydrogen peroxide for 80 cents. See, the stuff can be gotten for hardly any investment, and it lasts for a very, very long time, and you can use it on a day-to-day basis. Oh, I'm supposed to take.